the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 383 premium for Thursday, February 23rd, 2012.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions, you send in your tips. We do our darndest to answer your questions, share our own tips, and all together, we try to learn something new each time. For here, from Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton, apparently with a new set of lips today.
And here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun. Did you put that like in an echo chamber? What filter did you put the theme through?
Oh, actually, that was a listener did that completely on their own and sent that in. Yeah. Pretty cool, huh? Yeah.
It's different.
There you go.
Took me by surprise. I thought we were having Skype issues.
Well, we were. You just didn't know it because the theme was different, so you couldn't tell. So, you know what? Let's dive right in. We've got some great tips. We always have some great tips, but especially so today, I feel. And this first one, man, I feel so dumb because it's something that has existed in the OS for a really long time. And I never knew about it until Scout sent his email in today. And the email says, sometimes I reply to a message when I mean to reply all. Sometimes I reply all when I mean to reply to just the sender. Mostly I choose the wrong one because I use the keyboard shortcuts of Command R or Command Shift R. When I choose the wrong one, I have to close the reply window and start over. Today, my fingers were flying so fast that I used the other keyboard shortcut before closing the wrongly addressed message window and was amazed to see that Apple Mail hot swapped the addresses right in the same reply window. Sure enough, choosing either reply or reply all from the keyboard or the menu commands resulted in mail toggling between just the sender's address and all of the recipient's addresses being in the message. Dude, this is huge for me. I don't know about you folks out there, but for me, I do this all the time. I'll start replying and then realize, oh, I meant to reply all. And I close the thing and I do reply all and I start typing again. And you don't have to. I even tried it just now. It works in Snow Leopard and in Lion. You just start typing and you can toggle back and forth as many times as you want until you click send and you don't lose anything in your message. It just repopulates the two in CC fields appropriately. So. Awesome stuff, man. I so wish I'd known that a long time ago, but now we all know it.
I think reply all should be illegal.
What?
The only reason I say that is, you may not have run into this, but I ran into this more than once, on enterprise email systems, especially when they use what I'll say is like a macro.
Okay.
Like all employees.
Oh
gosh. Yeah. I saw this once, and what happens is they give people the ability to reply to all employees.
No, that's
and it snowballs into, you know, and then people start typing unsubscribe and please stop sending. And the problem is people keep replying, not realizing that they're replying to everybody in the company. And it's hilarious. I've seen that happen a couple of times. I think they eventually figured out they got rid of these macros because they cost more batch or whatever you want to call it, mailing lists.
Sure.
Because it just caused grief.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think reply all is fantastic. It's excellent for email trails and all of that good stuff.
As long as you're careful.
Oh, yeah.
As long as you use improperly.
If you're doing it intentionally, then it's great.
Improperly. Yeah. Is that a word? It may not be a word.
It is.
Okay.
It is. And Mark wrote in. Mark said, while I was listening back to Mac Geek Gab 381, the guy that wants to regularly connect to a server using AppleScript, I thought of a different way to do it. He says, what I do is something similar using Keyboard Maestro, and I write a macro which uses the time as a trigger and will run an AppleScript daily at a certain time. You can duplicate the macro and change the time. The time triggers are good for other things as well. And he's right. You know, Keyboard Maestro, you think keyboard, but certainly it is totally possible to do time-based triggers for all of this stuff. And so there you go. Yet another option. If you don't want to have to edit the Mac OS cron scripts and all of that to get your stuff to run, that's how you can do it. So Thank you, Mark. Good stuff. Poor man's cron. Well, actually, not poor man's, because you got to buy a keyboard maestro, but a little more, a little better GUI to control it, I guess.
And up next.
Yes, sir.
Because I see a special symbol here that means I get to read this. So we got something from Bill, and Bill writes, "Hi, Dave, John, and Pilot Pete. Here's an alternative to iWeb once it is retired. This is for web pages. My school is using Weebly, www.weebly.com. Very easy to use. They have a free version and a pro version that offers some more features," and he gives some of the pricing here. But even the free version is a great deal. So I took a quick peek at this, and it looks like a web-based method of hosting and building web pages, which...
That's great. Cool.
Didn't really try it, but yet another option for all those people that are going to get jettisoned from MobileMe in months. It's coming, folks. Sooner than you think. I think Apple's actually been sending reminders to people.
Yeah, I didn't get one, but some people on the TMO staff did. We ran an article about it. I guess, I don't know, Monday or Tuesday, I guess. But I don't know. Do you think they're going to release an update to Snow Leopard that has iCloud in it? Because I do. I think that has to come before the sunset.
I hope they do, because I'm seeing a lot of people that I follow and just general chatter from people saying, so really, I got to move to Lion in order to do this? And that right now for Mac, and I don't understand it. Well, I think I do understand it, but right now iCloud is Lion only.
Correct.
And the thing is, if you look at it, but on the Mac side it is, but on the Windows side, from what I recall, you can use either, I think, Windows 7 or Vista. So on the Windows side, I find it odd that they're offering multiple options as far as the operating system you can use with iCloud, but not on the Mac side.
And there were reports of back in like August or September. I never saw this in the developer portal, but there were reports where people said that they saw maybe a limited access trial of a beta of 10.6.9 that had an iCloud pref pane in it. So it certainly was developed. It's interesting that it has not resurfaced. That's perhaps a little troubling. I don't know.
Right. I guess they just want to encourage people to migrate to Lion. But to me, it's not a technical. I don't think it's a technical issue. It's
No, clearly not. James wanted to remind us all that in Lion, of course, you have the files are locked after a certain period of time. And he wanted to remind us that you can set that period of time. The default is 2 weeks. But if you go into system preference, it's in a weird spot. It's in system preferences, time machine options. And you can set the time after last edit before files are locked to 1 day, 1 week, 2 weeks, 1 month, or 1 year. And there might be more if you're willing to edit a plist file, but suffice to say that's probably enough for most folks. But I want it to be 3 weeks and 2 days, John, just for the record. And then lastly, from in the tip section, actually, lastly, Tony, through the course of answering a question for Tony, it came up that in all versions of OS X, and this is just a fun little tip. There's few things that will actually be useful that come from this, but when you hit the little yellow minimize box, it does that little genie effect where it scoots down into the menu. Well. You can slow that down by holding down the shift key and it will go down very, very slowly while you have the shift key down, and the same with waking it up. Now, I think this was just done so that Apple could demo it on stage and show how sexy it is and that it's actually doing the whole thing with the active stuff in the window. But it is kind of fun. Show your friends, show off for your friends. And you can also change those genie effects, can't you, John? If you go into the dock system preferences, right? You can use the genie effect or the scale effect. And then I think there's one more if you're willing to run a third party to set it. So it's in system preferences, dock, and then minimize windows using Genie or scale.
I don't concern myself with such eye candy.
Eye candy is fun though. I mean, that's, you know, I mean, that's part, it's part of the OS. It's
if good. You got, if you have the horsepower.
Yeah. Although it seems like, man, if you change that to scale, I bet your system feels faster.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway. All right. So that's our tips there. Anything to report, John, this week before we move on to Javier's question?
No, I want to dive into these questions.
All right.
I think
cool.
We got some good ones here.
I couldn't agree more. All right. Javier writes, I have a couple of minor issues with my Mac that may or may not be related, and they may be related to the short username. Essentially, last year, I ran into problems with my user account that required me to create a brand new user account. My old account's short name is not the same as the one for my new one, and I think this may be messing a bit with my system. Not enough to cause any serious problems, but enough to be annoying. The first issue is not so much an issue as a question. When I look into my preferences folder, I see a bunch of things ending in .lock file. What are these things? It's all over the place, and I don't think they were there under Snow Leopard. And then number two, the second issue has to do with the background color for certain windows. macOS allows you to change the background color either system-wide or on a window-by-window basis. In the past, I found this to be very useful because I like to change the background color of certain windows, as you see in the screenshot he sent. However, if I modify file organizations, such as arrange by name, for example, the background color goes back to the default white and the color option becomes grayed out in the preferences in the Finder. Okay, so let's start with the second one first, since we just read that one. The answer is yes. When you are the only time that you can have and set a custom background color is when the Finder preferences are set to arrange by none, which means custom arrangement. And that is that. So it's under the view, right? Is it under the view menu, John? Is that, wait, do I have that right? Yeah. Yeah. It's under the view menu and arrange has to be set to none. So view. It's show view options. But if arrange is set to anything else, you cannot set the background color in Lion. In Snow Leopard, you could. So that is a change in Lion. And back to the first question, lock files are also a change in Lion. I think they were previously hidden. I'm not convinced that they're new, but certainly their appearance is new. And they may very well be new, but it stands to reason that they were there before. Typically, lock files are used to indicate, like, you know, for example, you might have com.apple.mail.plist.lock file. And that means that the file without the .lock file extension is in use by something. And it's there to tell other applications, don't mess with this. I'm using this file. So it's a normal thing. I have it on my computer with Lion. I could certainly check it here in Snow Leopard, but I don't think it was there. Do you know anything about this, John?
I've seen them online. I didn't really look for them on Snow Leopard.
Okay.
I'll go with you on that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm looking in Snow Leopard and I don't see them at all there, but let's look at hidden files. And they are not here either. So we simply don't have lock files in Snow Leopard. So they are new to Lion. That's interesting. I wonder what construct they used in Snow Leopard to keep things safe. Or maybe they didn't, and maybe that's why they added it to Lion.
Could be.
All right.
Next. Is this me now? Yeah.
Yeah, go.
Okay. And actually, I got a last minute update here, but now I can actually see this now because I'm running. Now, of course, now that I moved to IMAP mail, I'm running mail on my podcasting machine, so I can see the interaction. Because our Mac Geek Gab mail is on now, IMAP now.
Wait a minute. Is having email on your podcasting machine a good thing? Is that going to cause even more distractions and all that stuff? Because I have a real hard time if I have to quit mail on my podcasting machine while we're podcasting. Otherwise, I get totally distracted.
No, so. I'm okay. I'm only using it right now for the purpose of reading the ongoing conversation
that we're
having here.
Got it.
No, if I was running Twitter, then it would be a lost cause.
Right.
All right.
Right.
Yeah, and I stopped doing that during the podcast. It's just rude. Well, yeah. We did it sometimes. All right.
Yeah.
So here's a note that we have from Dr. Michael. And he started off by sending us a URL, and it's a double click .net URL. I'm not going to read it off. I don't think it's terribly important. But here's the problem. So he started off by saying, if Chrome is the default, Chrome opens. If Firefox is the default, Firefox opens. And if Safari is the default, it opens with the exact same URL. So what's happening is his browsers, and then we'll dig into this a bit here. And he said, this started yesterday with no warning. I did not install anything or else. Help me, Mr. Wizards. So I stepped in as trying to be a wizard here. And I wanted to try to break down this problem here, at least to ask a question. And the first question is that in almost every browser, typically in the general preferences, they have something called a home page. And so what I was wondering is, and it's the first page that you'll see if you open the browser. You don't have to, but a lot of people do. Like, I think I set mine to apple.com just for fun. And I was just saying, you know, is it possible another program may have set this value, which I think it's in a plist file. So if you got a program, it may do that. It may set your home page when you open the browser. So he got back to me on that. So I thought, yeah, I figured this out. Well, I didn't. But I have some more. So then he got back and said, okay, the homepage designation remains the same on all my browsers, but here is more information. The default browser auto launches at boot. I do not have to open it.
So it's not that this page is opening every time he opens his browser. It's that this page is opening in his default browser every time he starts up.
Right. And how could this be? And I'm going to tell you.
Go.
Right, I have two things. Then he goes on. So one, it's always the same exact URL. And three, the URL is loaded in a second tab. The default homepage is loaded in the first tab, and a second tab is opened with this URL.
Oh, interesting.
So, and this is why I'm reading the email trail here. Now, here are two thoughts that I have, Dave. So I was asking myself, I talked to myself. How could a browser possibly open a URL when you log in? And I'm going to tell you how. It actually surprised me.
Yeah,
I did some research. So there are two ways that you can do this. I found not one, but two ways. So one, which surprised me, and you know, this part of the OS becomes more and more flexible the more I look at it here. So one thing you can do, now if you're in a browser and you click on a website and you drag it to the desktop, what it's going to create is a webloc file, weblock, which is basically a URL inside of a file, and it has the .weblock. And that's kind of handy because if you need that later and you double click on it, it's going to open that web page in your browser. Kind of neat, huh? I don't know if you ever tried that or if you even found it useful.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm asking you, Dave.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, right. It's a handy little thing. You can drag them into, you know, apps like Yojimbo or email or whatever, and they work great.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's a standard way to represent a URL or web address in a file. Here's the thing. Well, one thing you could do with this, Dave, is if you take that file and you go into accounts and login items and you drag that into the login items, well, what's going to happen is when you log in to your computer, it's going to open your default browser and go to that link. So I'm wondering if either intentionally or inadvertently, either some program put that in the login items list, or if maybe someone accidentally dragged a weblock file into the login item list.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like has happened for sure.
Because that I verified that'll happen, and it'll appear as a web location under the kind of document. Most of the things you're probably going to see in login items are applications. But as we mentioned, you can drag different things. And I didn't know if this would work. I've never found a reason to do it. So that's one possibility. But here's the other possibility. There could be a plist file running a terminal command. Now, this brings up the second question. How can you open a URL in a web browser from the terminal?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know.
And
the
I'm
going to that.
Give you the answer because I did a little Google foo and I found this out. So if you type at the terminal the word open space and a URL like http://www.macgeekgab.com, it's going to open that web page in your browser. Huh?
Yes, it does. Hey, that's pretty good, man.
I never tried that before, but I was poking around and the question was, how do I open a web page in from the terminal? And that's how you do it. So what I'm suspecting,
that's interesting because you can open a file that way too. I mean, you can say open, you know, /users/Dave/document/whatever and open a file, but it does say in the man page, if the file's in the form of a URL, the file will be opened as a URL. That's awesome.
Oh, you look at the man page for open. Okay.
I did.
Very good. So what I'm suspecting, and I don't know if we still have to get the answer back as to if one of these two things are possible, but I said, look in using something like Lingon, or you could look manually, but maybe someone or some program put a plist file in either launch agents or launch daemons or something that is doing this on your behalf. I don't know why it would.
Right.
So my strategy here was finding out how could you possibly open a URL in your default browser? And as far as I can tell, these are, I don't know if they're the only two ways, but the two ways that I could on short notice figure out. Maybe there's another way to open a URL when you log in, but this is what I came up with. So we'll wait for Dr. Michael to get back to us and let us know if either of these are true. If not,
back to the drawing board.
You know, I mean, maybe you get a hint in the console of who's trying to do this because it's certainly not normal behavior.
Yeah. But the fact that it's happening, like you said, in all in whatever his default browser is, tells me that, it would have to be something like what you've described. Yeah.
All right.
Moving on to Ken. Ken says, after researching iCloud for a while now, I decided it was time to migrate. No problems at all. All data was available and all looked good, apart from Yojimbo syncing, but here's hoping that is up and running soon. And he's right. Yojimbo still only syncs with MobileMe, but word is from Barebones that they are working on changing that to presumably iCloud, although they haven't made that entirely clear. Anyway, he continues, I came from having a .Mac account, which became MobileMe. I used Pop to download my mail to my main computer. Before migrating to iCloud, I bought a new Mac Mini, copied the emails from my old Power Mac, and all just fine. Then I realized that iCloud does not support Pop emails, only IMAP. Okay, I have to move with the times, I see that, but I'm confused about one big thing. My mailbox is huge, has many folders and rules to move mail to many correct places. I have a few aliases, and these are basically attached to the different folders. I need to redo my mail account in OS X Mail, but I don't want to lose anything. And also, I don't require older emails to be accessible via iPad, iPhone, web, etc. But I do need them for business tax and historical purposes. So can I export my emails first so I don't lose any, delete and recreate my account as IMAP in OS X? But can I also create locally stored mailboxes and have emails moved into these with rules to keep things organized and have them not appear in the cloud, as that is not necessary for me? What is my best course of action? Okay. So the best thing for you, is going to be to maintain local folders. And the way mail represents those is it calls them on my Mac. There is a little header, especially once you've added an IMAP account, you'll see the mailboxes header in the list, and then you'll see a header for each of your IMAP accounts. And then below that, typically, although you can move these around, is going to be the header for on my Mac. On my Mac is your local folders. And of course, you can archive things into those manually by dragging, or as you mentioned, Ken, with rules that move things in. There's no need to, as far as migrating from Pop to IMAP, there's no need to archive and then re-import. Of course, archiving as a backup step, just in case everything falls apart, that's not a bad idea. But once you've done that, here's the way it's going to work. When you, the process is going to be as you describe, but listen first and then do it, because there's a very important caveat that we're going to discuss. But essentially what you're going to do is you're going to delete your Pop account and then re-add your IMAP account. But everything that was in those on my Mac folders is going to be there because they're just on your Mac and they're not assigned to any one mail account. And that's the important part. Now, I said there's a caveat. When you pop mail, typically, and for the purposes of this discussion, let's assume that this is true for you. Typically, your pop mail is not going to reside on the server once you've downloaded it. Right. So once you've downloaded something into your inbox, the only place it lives is in your inbox on your Mac. Well, here's something interesting. When you delete that POP account, it deletes all of the folders associated with that account, which include your inbox, your sent box, your drafts, your outbox, if it exists, and your trash and junk mail, potentially, depending on how you've got that configured. So you're going to want to, really what I would recommend doing is add your IMAP account first and then delete the POP account. But in between, move everything over. So if you want all the stuff that was in your POP sent folder to be in your IMAP sent folder, just drag inside mail, highlight, you know, select all, drag it to sent. The same thing with your inbox. And of course, if you want to keep your trash folder, you would do the same thing with that. Then once that move has finished, and you can check that by going to the window menu, activity, that will show you a little activity window to tell you what mail is doing in the background. And once that window is empty, then you know that you're safe to delete your POP account. So that's a little trick there. But yeah, know that your POP inbox, especially including those other folders, goes away when you delete that account. And when I say deleted, I mean going into mail preferences accounts and removing it from the list. You could also just make it inactive by choosing the account and going to advanced and unchecking the enable this account box, but maybe that's a good way to test to make sure you've got everything you need before you go ahead and blow it away. So any thoughts on this, John?
You know, I did pretty much the same thing when I was migrating. So I took the contents that were stored locally.
Yep.
Dragged them over. The only hitch I ran into is that apparently my email was migrated. You know, I migrated it from Eudora and I never really archived it. And I think over time, some of it got corrupted because what happened is then when I tried to copy things over from the local folder to the IMAP folder, the copy operation would often stop.
Mm.
I think when it found a message that was not formed properly, I don't know if it was mail or the receiving IMAP server, but usually what happened is one or more headers or the contents of the email were, you know, there was a weird ASCII character or something in there and somebody just gave up and said, oh, I'm going to stop copying.
Right.
So one suggestion is you may want to copy in, because then the problem is I had to find out where it left off. So,
okay.
So one suggestion. So maybe you don't want to copy the whole enchilada there.
Well, yeah, for him, he in fact doesn't want his archives online.
Okay.
You know, so we're just talking about inbox and sent, but depending on how you manage your mail, those folders could be substantial. So yeah, definitely good advice.
Cause mine, I never really archived anything. So I have all my Mac Observer emails back from day one.
Right.
I mean, I have like 10, tens of thousands.
Yeah.
And they got corrupted, as I mentioned along the way. So.
All right.
What is next? Oh, this is a good one. Okay. Get on the hardware. Well, we have a tip here or a confirmation. And then we have a little hardware geekiness here.
All right.
So who is this? Douglas. All right. So Douglas says, Dave and John, not John and Dave this time. And of course, Pilot Pete. So first the tip here or the confirmation, because we suspected this or I think I was dancing around this last time, but he confirms it. On your last show, you talked about restoring a Lion Recovery partition and you mentioned the Lion Recovery Disk Assistant. Another option is using Carbon Copy Cloner. The latest version supports cloning of the Lion Recovery disk. Along with the main drive. You can then use that clone to boot another Mac and install just the Lion Recovery disk. I tried it and it works without a hitch. So
that's good.
Thank you for the confirmation. I suspect the other utilities that do full disk copy can do that as well, as long as they understand what a partition is, which I think they do, right?
They kind of have to, yeah.
Okay, so that's great. Now, here's the second one, all right, and this is the hardware geekiness. I also have a question on RAM. My friend gave me a 2007 20-inch 2 gigahertz iMac. Since it came with two 1-gigabyte RAM chips, my friend replaced one of them with a 2-gigabyte chip. When looking at it, I noticed that it was a PC2 6400 800 megahertz chip. However, it seems that this model, iMac 7.1, requires a PC2 5300 667 megahertz chip. System information shows the 2 gig chip speed at 667 megahertz. Is there a problem using this RAM chip with this Mac? It seems to be working okay, but I'm going to buy another 2 gigabyte chip to give it a total of 4 instead of the current 3. And since RAM is pretty cheap, I was wondering if I should just go ahead and get 2 new chips for it and replace the PC2 6400 with the correct chip. So, dug into this a little bit because I've been scratching my head with all this.
I'm curious about this because this, I don't know what these numbers mean. I mean, I know what some of them mean, but not all of them. So,
and I'm going to tell you what I told him.
Okay.
That sounds
ominous.
And my reply was as follows. Hello, Douglas. There is not a problem with this RAM configuration, though it isn't optimal. And then I went into a bit here because I was curious about these numbers as well. So you have a number of parameters for these RAM chips here. So the first one is the general class of chip. And in this case, it's a PC2 chip. And that's the chip technology. And you may have seen this. There's PC, PC2. I think there's PC3. And none are compatible with the other. And I think they actually make it physically impossible for you to use one type of chip in a slot that expects another.
So, right. Okay. Yeah. But yeah, just because the physical layout of them does not fit.
And I think I tried this once and the same applies to the chips, whether they be in an iMac or, well, yeah, I guess there's really no difference. Because I remember I had some old memory chips at one point and I was playing around on my MacBook Pro and I'm like, you know what? I wonder if I could take one of my older memory chips and put it in. And I tried to plug it in and it wouldn't. And I was getting ready to break out the hammer and, you know, force it.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, wait a second. If a chip doesn't fit into a socket, there's probably a reason. And there was, because then I looked more closely and saw that the socket and the chip were physically different.
Right.
They're like, by the way, don't do this because I suspect if you do it, you're going to blow something up. So now the next number, and this is what this number means. So there's two that are measures of the performance of the chip. So the PC2 5300, what does the 5300 mean? Well, 5300, from what I get, that is the maximum memory throughput in megabytes per second. So that's nice to know. All right, so he mentioned two different chips. So he mentioned a PC2 6400 and a PC2 5300. So the 6400 can potentially, and I don't think it's guaranteed, but it potentially could transfer data up to 6,400 megabytes per second. Okay, that's kind of cool. And then the third is the megahertz, is the frequency of one of the clock signals. Now, a lot of these do clock doubling and stuff like that, but it's the frequency of a signal that drives the chip. And he also mentioned there's two, 667 and 800.
Okay.
And actually, if you saw this the other day, Google had a Google Doodle on hertz. So what is hertz? Hertz is the number of times something happens per second, but it was his birthday or something.
It would have been 168th birthday or something yesterday.
And so my answer to him is a question that I have, Dave. So what he's doing is he's putting a chip that's rated faster than what the machine needs. And there's no problem with that, as far as I know. Well, the machine, what it's doing is it's basically saying, okay, well, yeah, I'm going to talk to this chip at this speed because that's what that computer talks at. So I don't think there's any problem putting a faster or higher capability chip, assuming that it's in the same class, you know. So, of course, it's plugged in there. I don't see any problem with that. Now, the question I had, and I think you answered it, Dave. Now, I don't know what happens if you try to put a slower. This is just an open question I have. But I don't know what happens if you try to put a slower clock rate chip. It's like this machine is supposed to take 667 megahertz RAM chips. I don't know what happens if you put a slower chip, if it just. From what I can tell, it'll drag everybody down. So with any of these memory chips, if there's a slower chip in a bank, then all the chips are going to operate at that speed. And I don't know why you'd want to do this.
Yeah.
I've never really tried it. I think you mentioned you've tried it, and sometimes it'll work if you try to put a slower rated chip into a machine that's expecting higher rated.
Yeah, I've seen it work. It's been a long time since I've seen that work. But it's not advisable, obviously. And it depends. I mean, the motherboards have tolerances, from what I remember, that it would, you know, if you go too slow, it's like, yeah, no, that's not going to work.
You know, I think what happens at some level, it'll say, hey, you know, memory chip, what's your capability? And it'll say, oh, I can run this fast. Then it'll be like, oh, okay, I'll give you a clock at this frequency. Or it could just say, no, I need something faster. The only thing that I noticed is that, so this machine, like many Macs, according to the specs that I found, supports interleaving. So the only problem here So it's not so much the mismatch in the capabilities. I don't really see that as a problem. But the problem here is that there's a 2 gig chip and a 1 gig chip. So you're not going to benefit from what's called interleaving, which gives you a wider memory bus and, you know, typically a single digit percentage increase from what I've seen on the benchmarks.
Right.
So my advice would be at least, yeah. So do what he's going to do here is get it so you have two gig chips. If you want to, just for peace of mind or just OCD or whatever, you may want to make sure that the two chips are in fact, you know, marked the same or have the same advertised capability.
Right. Right. Cool. All right. We had quite a few emails, John, this week about hard drives, various things about hard drives, but certainly about hard drives. So why don't you lead us into this discussion, starting with Chris?
Oh, goodness. Oh, another one. Oh, two in a row. Okay. Guys, that's concise. I had used AJA system test to test the performance of storage, HDDs or hard disk drives, SSDs, solid state, in Snow Leopard, but it doesn't seem to work in Lion. When I push the start button, nothing happens. And I confirm this. I've used this in the past. I think AJA actually makes graphic cards and stuff, but for some strange reason, they make this hard drive benchmarking utility, which is great, and it lets you set all sorts of parameters, but nope, doesn't work. Press the button, it just sits there and says zero bytes throughput.
It just means that Lion makes hard drive slower. That's all, John. You're not believing the results.
Yeah, so I think they have to update it so it's not compatible with Lion, which is really kind of weird because I don't know why they want to change the API that's used for reading and writing files, but I guess they have.
Yeah.
Or they're doing something else wacky. I don't know. Do you have any other recommendations for quick and dirty read-write measurement tools that work well in Lion? Well, I found one that I've used in the past. It's probably not the best utility, but the price is right in that it's free. And I've used this, and it does run in Lion. So one that I found here is Xbench. Hmm. I think this has been out for quite a while here. I mean, actually, I'm looking right now. I'm looking at the page for it. Compatibility, Mac OS 10, 10.3.9. So this has been out for a while, and it does a whole bunch of benchmarks, including hard drive benchmarks, or at least very basic hard drive benchmarks. So it'll do, and usually the test that you're looking for in a utility is sequential read, sequential write, which means, you know, it's going to write to sequential sectors on the disk, which usually is going to be the best performance, and then a random read and a random write, and then also different block sizes. So it does all of those tests. I think it does 4K and 256K block sizes, and it does both random and sequential tests. So, and I ran it on my Lion machine and it works. So
cool.
I would say this is a program that'll give you the benchmarks. A better one, though it's a commercial tool, but the one that I like because it's very comprehensive is the drive measurement utility in Drive Genius.
I agree. That one's awesome. But,
well, just
but
because you're right, it does similar. Yeah. Well, it does similar. Well, I think it's a great package, but it does similar operations, but it also does more block sizes. So this Xbench only does two. Drive Genius, I think, does anywhere from 4K to like 16 megabytes or something. So you really get a good picture of the performance of the drive. And it also does, you know, the random read, random write, sequential. Right. And it shows you nice graphs and all that. So to me, you know, if you're going to be doing a lot of benchmarking, I think that's a better tool to get the big picture.
Cool.
Or you could just break out a stopwatch. Well, you know, seriously, I'll make a recommendation here because at long last, I'm wrapping up one of my product reviews here, but I did some tests here. And I would say that if you want to do some tests, seriously, get a stopwatch, or I actually use my iPhone. And a couple of tests that you may want to do, I would say the two major tests that you want to do, at least benchmarking a drive, is one, how does it perform with big files? So the two tests that I did is one is I took a big Wampen file, like a gigabyte file, and I copied it from one drive to another. To me, that's one measure of performance. And then another test I did was a folder about the same size, full of a whole bunch of itty bitty files.
Mm.
Because I think that stresses different aspects of the performance of the drive. And that if you're copying in a huge Wampen file, you're probably going to get the best performance that you're going to get. Whereas if you're copying a bunch of little files, then you get the whole latency issue, which is where rotational drives kind of fall down and SSDs really excel.
Right. Cool. All right. Scott has a very interesting question. He asks, I have a Netgear ReadyNAS Ultra 6 Plus, which is a network RAID unit, multi-drive network standalone file sharing and it perform various other functions. They're actually kind of cool. The other week, it reported that one of the disks had failed, and so I returned the drive to Amazon and got a replacement. The thing is, though, I was always curious to determine for myself if the drive was actually dead or not, and I wanted to try it in my Mac, but I had no external hard drive enclosure, so I decided to buy one just in case another hard disk failed at some future point, and I had the means to test it. I love that geek thinking. That's awesome. He says, a few weeks went by, and I've now just been told that my NAS has another hard disk in it that's failed, a different disk in a different drive bay than the original one that had failed. So this time I put the drive in my Mac's external USB enclosure and ran Disk Utility. I repartitioned the drive, and lo and behold, the drive appears to be perfectly usable. I've tried copying files to and from the drive, and it works flawlessly. It's a Seagate green 5900 RPM drive, which I think is similar to what you have in your Drobo, John. It says, I had a look on the Seagate website, and their only hard drive diagnostic tool is Windows only. So what do you think? Should I regard the drive as failed, even though my Mac seems perfectly happy with it? Should I invest in something like Drive Genius, which seems pricey just to test the odd drive? This, of course, coming from a man who was willing to buy an enclosure to do that, but I get your thinking. Or do you know of any other software solutions which are cheaper that I could try? Any ideas would be appreciated. So, yeah, the interesting thing here is I would actually, before you drive yourself crazy, is I would get with Netgear's tech support. And they're usually pretty good. I've dealt with them before. And determine and find out what criteria they use to determine whether or not this drive has actually died. They, instead of looking at like read or write failures, they might be looking at, you know, every hard drive maintains a count and a really a table of what blocks it knows to be bad on the disk. Now, typically drives come from the factory with some bad blocks, and they're just mapped out and everything's fine. Also, drives typically come with extra blocks so that as other things go bad, those can be reassigned. And there's a limited number of these. And so it's possible that somehow Netgear is reading this information from the drive and deciding, you've surpassed what Netgear has programmed me to consider an acceptable number of bad block remappings, and therefore I'm going to report you as bad. And it, you know, in a NAS unit, you're relying on this drive all the time. You may be relying on it for mission critical data. You know, you might probably doing some kind of RAID with it where you've got redundancy. And so this thing is being hyper protective of the places where you store your data. So it's possible that that's all that's going on here. And yeah, when you mount it with Disk Utility and repartition and test, it's going to work fine. But it's just gotten past the point where Netgear says, no, we're not going to live with this anymore. Because at some point, all drives will fail. And that's, I think, Netgear's goal is to get you to replace this thing before it actually craters and you start either losing data or lose protection without it being properly prepared. So that's my guess, John. But if you've got another guess, I'd love to hear it.
Oh, no.
You're laughing.
I'm just wondering if this Netgear thing is a piece of garbage and it's blowing up drives.
Well, but it didn't blow up the drive. The drive works fine.
Yeah, but it sounds like I was kidding.
Oh, okay. No,
I've never used this Netgear stuff, but yeah, I'm with you. I think it's criteria for determining that a drive has failed may be more robust than.
Right.
Yeah, it's part of the enclosure or whatever algorithm you're using. You know, it's funny you tell that story about the bad block remapping. Remember the days when you actually had to punch in the bad block list manually into the disk controller?
I do. Yeah,
I remember doing that. Yeah, the drive would say these blocks are bad and you had to manually punch it into the controller so it would know to skip them. That was the bad old days. The other thing I could suggest here is I'm not sure how this would work with NAS, but, you know, we're talking about Drive Genius again, but it really is a nice program. And one thing that I used with it on my mini here is that they have an optional drive health monitoring system called Drive Pulse. Which I really like. So you have
that's similar to what his RAID is doing, right?
I mean, it may be doing the same thing, but if you don't have a RAID, that kind of does its own integrity checking, I guess. What's nice about Drive Genius is if you run this drive pulse utility, it does three different things on a regular basis. It'll check the fragmentation of the drive. It'll, let me see, check preferences. I'm looking right now at my mini, and then it'll do a volume consistency. Yeah. Volume consistency check, which is something that I think is in addition to things like smart, which are supposed to tell you that things are going bad, but it may not, but it also does this on a regular occasion. So it's kind of a, it's nice that it does this for you. It just complements what other utilities may detect eventually. And that it runs these things again, it schedules them and it runs them, whether it's once a week or depending on the test here. But I like that it does it for the most part. What it's done for me has been telling me when my drive is too fragmented. And then you can run a and it's kind of neat because you say, OK, defragment. It reboots into a special mode like command line mode, does it, and then reboots your system again. I think it's really nice for again, if you don't have a RAID or other Drobo or a system that checks for bad drives, then yeah. I think the Drive Genius utility, because the thing is, people are rarely going to be running disk utility and doing an integrity check on their own.
Right.
So it's nice that this hides in the background and kind of does it for you and alerts you if something's amiss.
You know, I started this thing where I was ranting about Drobo and perhaps there's other options. And this is one of the things that's been on my list. But as we've been going through it here, I realized that this NAS is they tout it as the first NAS that is TiVo compatible in terms of being able to push video to and from your TiVo natively inside the NAS, which is something I do all the time from my Drobo, but I can't do it natively in the Drobo. I have to have a Mac running that essentially does that, you know, handshake for me. So, yeah, we got to check out these. This is good stuff. Maybe it's but they, you know, I'm curious about the speed of them, because that's really been my issue with the Drobo is the speed of it when dealing with small files and even the speed, the amount of time it takes just to mount the thing too. It's just slow in terms of like serving movie files, like I talked about, you know, to my TiVo, totally fine. Even HD quality stuff, totally fine. You know, I mean, the throughput of it is no problem. It's the latency as it's jumping around with these little files that makes it really, really tough to work with. You know, I had my iTunes library on mine for a while and it was just like too much. I couldn't wait. You know, when I click play on a song or I try to get info on a song and I have to wait, you know, 20 or 30 seconds before it would get the data. And I'm like, oh, this is for the birds, man. And heaven forbid somebody else in the house was running a Time Machine backup too. I mean, the whole point of the thing was that you can have these chopped up and partitioned Time Machine stores, which is awesome. I mean, it's great. It's a great idea. But if you've got multiple people backing up simultaneously, you know, forget it. It takes forever. So, which maybe stands to reason, but in a general sense, even if nobody else is using the drive, it's just slow for small files. And so that is sort of the frustrating thing I deal with the Drobo. But otherwise, I really like it. So I don't know. I want to check
the thing that I notice is when it's slow to appear on my network, when I wake my machine up.
Yep.
That's one of the things I notice. And a lot of times things, because I have my machine do schedule Time Machine backups. A lot of times what will happen is Time Machine will wake up and say, oh, I'm looking for the drive. And it eventually times out and says, I can't find your Time Machine drive. It's the Drobo. I don't know what the Drobo is doing. The thing I do like.
That's interesting. I certainly see it take a long time to mount, but I've never seen it fail to start a Time Machine backup. You've got different drives in yours than mine. And I think that's part of this whole thing is we've both chosen to go with green drives. I have Western Digital green drives. You've got Seagate.
No, I got the same as you. No, I got the ones you recommended.
You got the ones I recommended, which are not the ones I own because
thanks.
Yeah. Well, no, they were, I mean, it was the Seagate ones at the time were cheaper than the ones I had. So yeah, I've got Western Digital green drives. You've got Seagate green drives and maybe yours take longer to spin up than mine, but perhaps that's the reason that these things are slow. I don't know. It's interesting. I reached out to the folks at Drobo, and even sent them a link to the show and
nope,
and
I got the WD.
Oh, okay. Then do I have Seagates?
No, I'm ADD here. No. So I'm looking on my other computer here and I have a folder full of receipts. And yes, I got three 3 Western Digital Caviar Green 2 terabyte SATA 3 Intel Power 64 megabyte cache bulk OEM desktop drives.
Okay, so whichever it is, I don't think we have the same drives. I think you have WD, then I have Seagate. I remember that when we were going through it. But
and amazingly, those at the time cost about $270.
Yeah, I know.
Which, I think the price has tripled since then.
It's crazy. It's crazy.
So, I guess they had these, some plant somewhere got flooded or blown up or something. So
huge problems over there. Yeah.
The other thing I like about the Turbo is it does have an alerting mechanism. I don't think it's on by default, but I remember this when I first got it and I played around with it. I'm like, you know what? Just for kicks, let me pull a drive out and see what happens. And as soon as I did, it sent an email saying, somebody did something stupid with the Turbo. Can you check on the Turbo? Somebody did something.
Yeah.
Which was me pulling a drive out.
Right.
Well, another time I actually did have, I think I told you, I had a drive that was sitting around my office here. Yes, my office, not my room. Sitting around my office here for a couple of years. It was one of the ones that I think came in my original PowerMac G5. And it was like a 300 or 500 gig SATA drive. One of the first SATA drives. And I popped it in the Drobo. And after less than a week, apparently the drive was just at the end of its lifetime. And I got the red light and I got an email saying, hey, the drive died. I'm you know, doing a reconstruction, but you probably want to pull this drive and put another one in. Mm. And I think I even took it out and, you know, I don't know if I dropped it or beat it with a hammer or something and put it in again. And yeah, it came up again and it said, no, really, this drive is shot, dude. What are you doing? So I think it's one of the first drives I've ever had physically die on me before I tossed it and upgraded to a larger capacity.
Well, that's good. That means you got the full use out of it. Yeah, man, drives are expensive. So I did my my OCD thing too here. And I have the Seagate Barracuda drives, 2 terabyte drives that I bought in July, and I paid $79.99 a piece for them.
Okay, about the same thing. I think so I paid like about $80-something each. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you look now,
twice the price.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Where are we going next? I think I know
Jed.
Where we're going next.
I think it's time for Jed.
And it says I got to read this again. Okay. Yeah. Let me get Jed up here. Jed, there's Jed. All right. No, that's not Jed. Ah, okay. All right. You want me to take this one? Well, I think I'm getting the email in the middle here.
Okay.
I don't know if I got the entire email here because it seems to be starting off on a... No, I'll go here. John had mentioned that he put... all right, so it's talking about my mention of playing around with SSDs and regular 2.5-inch hard drives. So Jed said he started looking at them. And I think what he has right now, he has his eye on a 750 gigabyte. Yes, they're growing, because I think when I looked, they were only 500. So I think they got 750, and now I think they may actually have terabyte 2.5-inch drives that are typically used in portables. But he said, I keep reading that it can get pretty loud. I want to put this in a Mac Mini headless computer, which I use as a media center. The hard drive I currently have hooked up makes a bunch of sounds and can be annoying. So now I want to consider this when buying. So my question is, do you notice the volume or the noise of the drive? And my answer is as follows. So the drive that I got when I was looking at, I think it was around October 2010 when I was looking at my records here. So I upgraded from the...
People are going to think we're crazy, you know, being able to pull this stuff up and find our orders and all that. But that's the beauty of all this stuff.
It's what we do.
That's
right. Well, I want to look up the date here. So the thing is, my computer, I believe my Mac when I ordered it, came with a 250 gig or thereabouts Hitachi hard drive. Okay. So when I think that this would be my general advice when you're upgrading your hard drive in any Mac is... at least take a look at the same series of drive and just see if it's gotten larger. And in this case, it did. So it not only got larger, but the performance increased. I think they increased the cache. They increased the platter. So everything got better with this drive. And I think all the companies that make the rotational drives are doing this. The technology just keeps advancing. The particles get small. All the great stuff. So that was the fastest rotational drive I could find. It's a Hitachi 7K500 series.
Okay.
So I decided to go with that, and I figured it's a safe bet because the drive that was already in there was also a Hitachi similar. I don't think it was a 7K. It was but it was a similar, no, I think it was a 7K500 series. It was just smaller. And then to make my selection, what I did is I went to a site that I certainly recommend, but it's called Tom's Hardware.
Oh, I love that site.
And it's really platform independent in that I think they ran the benchmarks on a Windows machine, but it doesn't matter. So I basically looked at, and every now and then they'll do a summary or a roundup of different types of drives. Whether they be, in this case, they had, I think, a 2009 2.5-inch mobile hard drive shootout. So I checked that chart, and this Seagate came out pretty much near the top in their benchmarks. And I think there were one or two others, but they were really much more expensive. So I made the choice to get this one. So I got in, March 2010. It's in the emails when I bought it. And I got it from OWC, and check this out. Now, you know, again, the pricing has changed, but I got not only the drive, but also an external USB enclosure because, you know, what are you going to do with your old drive? Throw it away? No, yeah. I wouldn't do that. And OWC has a whole bunch of kits that include the drive and a very basic USB 2 and maybe now USB 3 enclosure. But I got that for $129.99, which I think was a great deal. And you're not going to get that anymore.
No.
Now, the only downside that I noticed is when I got it. So it wasn't a drive that was included, you know, of course, even though it was the same series, it wasn't the drive that came with the machine. And I think this was a problem because at first I thought I was going insane because I would be using the machine and I would hear a little.
That's not the click of death, is it?
I thought, well, you know, that was my initial thought because a lot of hard drives that you bring up a funny term and we toss this around in the industry. Right. But no, the click of death, a lot of drives before they fail or rotational drives, at least before they fail, will start making various noises. And one of them is, I guess, the head clicking around all over the place. And it's called the click of death.
Yep.
And it may not be a steady click, but it's a click. So, oh, you found it on Wikipedia, click of death.
Well, yeah, yeah.
So, but no, what it was doing, so it wasn't the click of death, because I think the click of death gets more frequent until the drive eventually rolls over. And since it was a new drive, I thought it's probably not the click of death. On the other hand, you know, a lot of electronic items, they'll either die when you first get them or they'll last for a very long time. So it could have been, but it wasn't. And then I got really annoyed and I'm like, you know, what is this chattering that it's making? And after doing a bit of research here, I found out what it was. There's a setting that apparently Apple set on the drive that came with the machine, but because this was a different drive, it wasn't set for whatever reason. And it's called APM. I think it's
Advanced Power Management.
Thank you.
You bet, man.
And advanced power management is a setting that you can make on a ATA or SATA drive that tells the drive how aggressively it should be doing power management. In other words, you know, how aggressive should it be in trying to save power, which, you know, in this case, if it's a drive that's in a portable computer with a battery, if the drive can, because, you know, the motor spinning take power. So if you can at all reduce that, you know, make the drive save power, that's a good thing. So I'd say it's probably one of the, maybe not the thing that draws the most power in the computer, but certainly it draws a bit. The problem is one way that drives like to deal with this is to move the head into a park position and spin down the motor. And that makes noise.
Click.
So this utility is a short utility. We will link to it in the lovingly handcrafted show notes. But it's basically a utility that runs on the startup of the machine and sets the value to not make the drive so aggressive about power save. Now, the downside is, yes, so my computer may not be lasting as long, but it's not going to me, eliminating the chattering noise. I mean, especially like sometimes I'll be using my machine at night and it's very quiet and all of a sudden I'll hear a chunk chunk from the computer. And it's the only noise I hear. And right. it some people may be able to deal with it. I couldn't.
You couldn't take it. Well, it sounds like Jed can't take it either. So
I mean, it wasn't ear splitting, but it was just this noise out of nowhere when normally now all I hear is the spinning of the motor. And to me, that's a nice comforting, you know, regular kind of white noise.
Right. That's right. They talked about that in Strange Brew, right? That you get paranoid schizophrenia from listening to that stuff.
What?
Don't you remember that movie? Strange Brew. No, Doug McKenzie.
Nah, it's been a while.
Yeah.
Great White North, eh?
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Anyway, back on track here. Greg, we got a couple of things and cool stuff found before we wrap this one up. Greg writes, regarding apps that do screenshots, add text and arrows, etc., I have tried Sketch, I've tried Little Snapper, and I've tried a program called Clarify It. Many of them are the same, but Clarify It is a little more user-friendly, and I love that it will actually give you free storage space and allow you to make a web page for sharing. You can add text, images, URLs, etc., and then share via email, PDF, RTF, their website, Clarify, and it is. It's pretty cool. So as opposed to other, you know, like Sketch has always been my favorite because I can not only take a screenshot with it, but I can right inside Sketch do some very rudimentary markup of it. I can edit it. I can like scrub things out. I can also draw arrows and circles and highlight things and then convert it into whatever format I want. And off I go. Well, Clarify It takes it to the next level. You can take, let's say I was doing a how-to for somebody and needed three or four screenshots. Well, you go and take the three or four screenshots and then you can assemble them together right inside Clarify It. And it becomes a little documented editor. And like he said, you know, you can, if you want to do it in email, you could do just RTF and have all the data there. You could save it to Evernote or Yojimbo. You could save it to, you know, a text edit document if you wanted, or you can output it as a PDF, or like he said, you can save it to their website and just give somebody a URL. So very, very cool. And thank you for hipping us to that. This is, I say it all the time, but this is the thing I love about this show, John, is we get to learn things too. And that is awesome. And Steve wants to suggest something called Franker, F-R-A-N-K-E-R. It's a Safari extension that will translate words or sentences and output them right on the web page next to the original. So you go into your Safari extensions and you set this to auto detect the language that it's coming from and then tell it what you want it translated to. And you can, of course, you know, for me, I would choose English. And in his example, he chose English. And then it's cool. He went to this website with some Japanese text and there's the, you know, katakana. And then right next to it is in parentheses and in green kind of offset is what that translates to. So really, really cool, especially as we all eventually find ourselves on websites where the text may not be in English. So cool stuff found indeed. Do you have anything to add to our cool stuff found pile before we rock this one out here, John?
A nice translation engine is Babelfish. Is it? I think it's babelfishyahoo.com.
Oh, okay.
We'll check that.
I always use the Google one, just google.com/translate.
See, Babelfish is another one. Of course, the Babelfish from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Yeah, Google is a good one, too. And actually, I found that the Twitter client that I use on my Mac, I'm not going to say it because it'll sound like I'm swearing, but
yes,
but it actually, I noticed this because some people I follow, I know I follow one person who occasionally will tweet in Arabic, another, yeah, in Japanese, another one in Swedish. So you highlight and I think I hit Command T and it'll sit there for a moment, spit it out to Google and then comes back and translates it, which it's such a cool aspect. You know, I mean, Twitter being global in general,
yeah.
But when you have people that are, you know, rude enough not to speak in my language, it's nice that you could translate.
Right. No, it's true. I did want to add a little context because I found it interesting. You said the Babelfish, of course, comes from the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which it does. But the name Babelfish, I mean, it was a fish, so that's why they called it a fish. But the name Babel actually comes from the Bible. Right. And the Tower of Babel. Right. It was in the Bible. And it was like the fall of the tower caused all the multiple languages that we have, I think, was the general gist of the story there. So, yeah, man, that's good stuff. Yeah. Translate.google.com is the URL for Google's. They all work quite well, in fact.
And I remember, actually, you know, if you haven't read Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, I think pretty much any of our listeners would appreciate it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah, it's fun stuff. All right.
But in my reflection on the Babelfish, and this is the final thing, just to show his humor here, a final comment on the Babelfish. What it did was basically translate so you could understand any language. And one of the quotes here I remember from Douglas Adams that just cracks me up. Meanwhile, the poor Babelfish, by effectively removing all barriers to communication between different races and cultures, has caused more and bloodier wars than anything else in the history of creation.
That's awesome. It's better if you two don't speak.
Because, hey, if somebody doesn't know that you're insulting them, then you're not going to get all worked up and yeah.
Yeah, you're good to go. That's true.
But it's a great series.
Yeah, it is fun. All right, let's see. Email. You folks get to email. Well, there's actually two email addresses that you get to use. Really, there's four. So we'll say them in order
what?
Here. No. Bear with me on this, John. So we've got premium at MattGeekGab.com, right? And then we've got premium at MattGeekGab.com. And number three would be, John?
Premium at MattGeekGab.com.
Correct. And then number four, so the first three are for your submissions. Questions, tips, hints, anything that you want to send to John and I for
cookies.
For the purposes of the show. Right, cookies. There you go. And then address number four is customer support at MattGeekGab.com. And that's if you're having any problems with your account. And that, it's really important to separate that out, especially now, because as I mentioned, I'm going on vacation next week. And so I may not see all of the email coming into premium at, but customer support at, in addition to going to John and I, also goes to Adam Christensen, who helps us out with all of our tech stuff on the back end here. And so he can help you out with any problems in our absence. So that's, it's really important to make sure you use that one for any problems you might have with the feed or your subscription or anything like that. And we really do, I know we say it all the time, but man, it's awesome being able to do this premium thing. And I really, that's thanks to all of you. So thank you very much.
Yeah, we say it all the time, but there may be people who are listening for the first time. And if you are, welcome.
Absolutely. That's right. We definitely have some new subscribers.
Because I know we get, yeah. No, yeah. I see it all. Yeah, we see the activity and.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it's great. I like our family is growing here.
Yes.
So other ways to reach us, I would say another way, Dave, in addition to email, is you pick up your iPhone, your Battlefield phone, two cans with a string, if you can dial a number on them, and you would call 206-666-GEEK, which is
4335. And you can also visit us on Facebook, facebook.com/MacGeekGab.
It's growing. Every time I go there, there's more people. It's
That's
amazing.
A beautiful thing. Twitter.com/JohnFBraun/DaveHamiltonIsMe/MacGeekGab is the feed for the show. /PilotPete is that guy who's been really busy lately. And /MacObserver, of course, is all the headlines from the Mac Observer all day long. I think that's it, John. I think we're out of here. As I said, I'm on vacation next week, so we will return on Monday, March 5th.
Wah!
Yeah.
Where are you going?
We're going down to Florida. Down on the Gulf Coast of Florida, Naples area, where
we've got some family down there. Not the Reedy...
The Reedy Creek Improvement District? No, that's right. That was the last one, so... All right. We'd like to thank Michael Johnston from the We Have Communicators podcast. He converts this to AAC for us and for you. Also, Cashfly for all the hosting and all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. It's a beautiful thing. Do you have anything to add? Anything to tell them here, John? Any parting words of wisdom that might be just the thing they need to make it through the next week without us?
Maybe not for them, but for you, Dave. I mean, if you're traveling, all I can say is don't get caught.
Made up.